Welcome to the Seven Figure Leaders podcast. This podcast was created to celebrate the success stories of seven-figure business owners, giving them a platform to share their insights and lessons learned in order to inspire other business owners. As well as that, it's an opportunity to build new connections. So if you're a seven-figure business owner or someone who works with seven-figure business owners, and you're looking for introductions to potential stakeholders, strategic partners, and clients, I'd love to hear from you or have you on as a guest and see if I can help make those connections for you. Just go to synergycfosolutions.co. That's synergycfosolutions.co and click podcast. And there you'll find the link to apply.
Welcome, and today we've got Elizabeth Williams. So Elizabeth, you've been involved in lots of businesses over the years, and now you're involved in helping businesses scale up into the millions and beyond that. So why don't you give a little bit of an overview as to kind of your background and what you do today and how you got into this?
Okay, thanks, Tom. Thanks. Great to be here. My background is pure cosmetics, beauty, some supplements, perfume. I started a number of decades ago and worked initially for blue chips, Elizabeth Arden, Estee Lauder, Revlon, Shiseido, all the big boys, learnt the trade. I came up the sales route, with some educational background in business and law. So I was quite useful to them and helped in terms of personnel, etc. And latterly, I suppose for the last 20 years, I've worked on consultancy improving businesses. And what I find now is most people hire me to do scale up of their small founder-led companies. That's what I tend to do. And that's what I've recently been doing in the last couple of years.
Okay. And what types of businesses do you typically help?
They are founder-led. So they tend to be bright ideas that have taken hold. So product innovation, research and development. The most recent was a skincare. None of the senior leadership team came from skincare, completely off-the-wall idea. So I tend to get asked to do cosmetics, skincare. I had a huge number of nail companies in the start of 2021 after COVID, because it was something that people could do themselves. So people were not going into salons. So there was a sort of baby boom, if you like, in nails. So I did a lot of nail companies. I'm still seen as an expert in nails, and I often give research for that. You know, I get asked to do things for some research companies, which I do. So I'm quite a, dare I say, smorgasbord of things that I do. And I do travel in mainly in Northern Europe, because that's where I'm quite comfortable. I don't like the heat, Tom. So I'm quite good. As you can see, I look quite Scandinavian, and my name's spelled in the German way. I'm not. But it works for me. But mainly, you know, we have a company turning over 2 to 3 million, 5 million. We want to be a £20 million company, because that has a mechanism in terms of acquisition. Once they reach 20 million, they become very attractive to big brands. So that's what they want to get to.
Okay. So when a company is doing 2 million, what do they look like and what do they need to become in order to be a company doing 20 million?
What they look like tends to be very mismatched to where they think they are. It's not hard with TikTok and other forms of social selling to get to those numbers. You can open with an order of £500,000. First order, for example, on some of the shopping channels, they will order that amount of stuff. But it tends to not have a strong leadership team. So there'll be a founder, there'll be a marketing person, there'll be a salesperson. It's usually very unstructured at 2 million. 5 million, you might start to see some structure, but the danger is they think they've got a very lucrative brand on their hands. And it's not really until you go into that 10 million plus that they start to invest money. They're very cautious of investing money, and that's one of the hardest things. Everything should happen organically, and it doesn't. You know that. And what they want to do is be the next Lauder or Pooch Group or whoever. And they don't realize that's taken a lot of investment. That's a big problem.
Mm. And so making that a bit more kind of tangible and relatable for anyone listening, perhaps you could give an example of a company that you've helped grow from that 2 million mark up to the 20, or perhaps some of those nail companies that you helped during COVID?
I think I'm going to go back a couple of decades to something that I've been quite famous for. I took on a supplement brand, which is a skincare brand owned by Novo Nordisk called Imodine, which you can buy in Boots or the like. And it was trading at 900,000. So it was what I call kitchen table brand. It wasn't. It was owned by a big boy. And they didn't
it was
really.
900,000. What do you mean?
Well, turnover of 900,000.
900,000. Okay.
And they wanted, it was a management buyout. And this was at the late 90s, early 2000. And what they wanted to do was obviously make it a big brand. It was well accepted in Europe. But at the time, the British didn't take supplements to look better. The whole health and fitness was not in play. Within 2.5 years, we'd scaled to £10 million, which is always my benchmark and was worth a lot more then, as you can imagine. We went on to do £55 million. But what we had to, within 5 years, we then eventually sold it to Pfizer. So what we had to do was to look at the USP, who used it, and get it was a skincare product. Nobody used it because it was a jelly capsule and then they liked it. You had to think about what the USP was. And for my sins, I was the only non-doctor. Everybody was a doctor, pharmacist, doctor, etc. Didn't understand it. Why would they understand it? This was fluffy. It was a fluffy. They made drugs for multiple sclerosis, etc. Some very high profile, decent drugs. What did they want this for? This was just something they did. And we did it through a process of identifying what the USP was, getting in a very, very good financial controller who was known to them, had been used by them before, but had never had any guidance. And we had to work remotely when it was absolutely not done. We also had to spend money, and that was the thing. So we were at 900 turnover, and I went to my vice president in Denmark and said, I want £1 million for advertising. And of course, they laughed me out of the room and said, you're not having it. To which I replied, you will not get to 3 million unless you spend 1 million. So you've got 1 million of rhetorical business, if you like. Then you've got to spend 1 million, and then you'll get 3 million. And, you know, he said, well, if you muck it up, Mrs. Williams, so I said, fine, let's give it a go. You know, gung ho, ready to go. We did. We got to 3.5 million.
What did that million go on? What was that invested in?
It was invested mainly in advertising because we had to change the narrative, and it was print advertising, Tom. So we had to change the internet. We used the internet, but it wasn't really. It was in its infancy. So that's what we did. We went to print advertising. We went to the influencers of their day and said, do you use this? Yes. Have a load free. We had lots of stars as well who had a load free. I can remember delivering it to a certain royal residence in my little bag. And that's how we built that business. And I used that model later on when I was dealing with a nail company. And they said to me, and this was only 3 years ago, they said to me, how do we get to be a bigger player? Because it's a big market and it's a growing market. How do we get, and they were French, how do we get to be a bigger player? well, I said, you're going to have to spend some money on advertising. And they said, no, Mrs. Williams, we don't spend. And I said, you're going to have to spend it.
Can I just ask that, right? So how did they think they were going to grow the business without investing in advertising?
They just think by word of mouth that they're going to get traction. And yes, you might get lucky. You might have a celebrity walk into a salon. If you're a nail person, you might have a celebrity walk into a salon, have their nails done, TikTok, tweet, whatever they're going to do. Yes, then you will have a viral situation. The problem is that doesn't happen very often because of the way that the service industry has changed. If you're famous, you've got some personal issues around security. So the more often than not, ladies will come to you. You don't go out and sit in a salon unless that's, you know, I can never remember. Is it Keanu Reeves who always goes out shopping on his own? But there are very few people that in that A-class that will actually go out, A-list that will actually go and have a service. When I worked in Harrods in the 80s and 90s, we saw everybody. I'd made up everybody as a makeup artist. I'd serviced everybody. No, you won't find that anymore.
Right.
It doesn't happen that. Personal security.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So back to it. So marketing. So marketing was the focus. They're
yes.
at a million, spend a million. Now they're at 3 million. And so that was all marketing. That was the only shift really that got them from 1 to 3.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were connections, but that's more about the senior leadership team. I brought some people in that had some really good connections, and I do that now. I've just put together a team for a new product in January, and that is from my black book. And we've got a team of 6 people that are experts in their field, and they're fractional. They don't want to go into the corporate world.
Yeah.
They enjoy building a brand. And that's what I did there. I brought in some top people and by a force of nature said, this is what you have to do. You have to spend money. You have to spend money on people. And that's really important. I just had a company that really wouldn't spend money on people. They had hidden part of their costs in incentives, shall we say, but not in salaries. And you have to spend money on people. And that's why I go back to the sort of robust CFO that is going to do a forecast and a financial plan in collaboration with the senior management team. But if you don't have that person, as a CEO, I'm not a challenger to them. They're there as a collaborative colleague, and that's quite important, and especially with marketeers, because CFOs often look at marketeers and think, right, you're spending too much. You have to quantify everything. And as the CEO, I have to oversee it and make sure that people are not, not challenging for challenging's sake when it makes a good, robust business argument to do it. It's like being a conductor of an orchestra.
Yeah.
If you like.
Yeah. Okay. So you've talked about marketing, number one, number two, leadership, and what else? Again, if we can perhaps use an example to make it relatable on that journey from, let's say, 3 million up to 20 or 50 or whatever number you want to go to.
Yeah, I think people are key. Again, you have to have the investment. You have to find the right people. You have to find people that are not looking, especially with startups, that are not looking for an early exit, that are actually in it for the long term, that want to invest their time in the company, growing the company. I'd love a dollar for every company that I go to say, right, Elizabeth, you're going to help us and we're going to sell in 3 years. And that happens a lot, but it shouldn't be the start of a company. It shouldn't be founded, in my professional opinion, it shouldn't be founded on a sale. You know, we start and we get money and then we sell as quick as we can and off, because it's not a legacy. And I'm now at a stage in my career that I'm interested in legacy for my brands and for me. I want to be doing good works. So I think it's important, the USP, the financial plan, and the investment are the things that, 3 points that actually make a company scale.
Yeah.
And if you don't have those, you're going to struggle.
Yeah. Yeah. And so how do you typically find the companies that you work with, and how many do you work with at a time?
It depends on the contract. I tend to do some what I call light work. I do some sort of individual work, some coachings to bring on a brand to develop an idea. But I always have a main brand that I'm associated with, because as you know, consultancy, sometimes you're under an NDA. You can't say that you're working with them. I've worked with a couple of famous skincare founders, couldn't say. So I tend to have a main company, like the one I've just finished, which is Tanzen, which is a acne brand. And then I do a little bit of work around it, depending on the contract. So it's always one, could be two, could be three. After that, no, it's too many. Then I bring in some of the people and they work with me, but they're part of my network that then work by my recommendation to the people that I can't handle that amount of work.
And then how do you typically work? Is it purely an advisory relationship and you get paid a retainer, or you get equity, or is it, are you actually involved in any of the day-to-day in the businesses?
Again, it depends on the company. A lot of people have been using shares within the industry, within the cosmetic industry, to get the high-level people through the door. That is fine when you're 30, 40, 50. It's not so great when you're older. If you're in your 50s like me, then you might not see that money until you're retired and you can no longer influence it. It's a risk like every other financial decision. I normally take a monthly fee, so a retainer. That covers my office. It covers my staff. They don't get charged anything else. Yeah. So I do all of the work with my staff. I bring people. If I have to bring in specialist people like a PR consultant, then they have to pay that person, not me. And occasionally I go on pay as you earn, because sometimes people in the financial CFO role don't like it. So they say, can you go on pay as you earn? And I pay my taxes. I'm a British woman. So I go on pay as you earn. Doesn't really make that much difference to me now. But that's how I work.
Okay. And what types of companies are you looking for? Obviously, you said scale up, you said cosmetics, but anything else?
I have in the past done luxury goods. So I've done jewelry. I've done accessories, so handbags, that sort of thing. I've done art and antiques. I've done houses, as in top houses. So all of my roles are based on luxury. I don't really do anything. If you said to me, I've got a supermarket role, I wouldn't really be able to help the client, because I don't really know anything about it other than buying my own groceries. I'm not able to tap into a network of people. I don't have those people on speed dial. So I tend to stick, you know, to the luxury goods. I am the customer. I buy a lot of stuff. And I think that helps in terms of understanding what people are looking for. But I think it goes back to those three principles, you know, USP and all of that. And I think that's important to me, and it'll be important to other people.
Anything else that you'd like to share with the audience?
I think there's an opportunity out there. We're talking about a cost of living crisis. But I think people in a cost of living crisis or a recession, which I've been through a couple of recessions as an employee and as a human being, I think people do spend, but I think they spend wisely. And I think that the quality is king. I think that cosmetics, if they can be made in the UK, is a wonderful USP. And we can make everything. And I've got a long list of contacts that make for my, you know, for my employers. And I think because of the, also because of the Brexit rules and trying to move things around Europe is still quite difficult for us. So we tend to, in the cosmetics industry, we have a big market here. Women like their makeup. They like their nails. I also think that we have a responsibility as a cosmetic industry to provide some sort of initiatives to women. And that was really important to me deciding on my next project, because the industry was founded by women post First World War. We probably know this, but it was founded to give employment to women that had had fiancés killed in the First World War. And they didn't have employment. So somebody like Elizabeth Arden actually took those girls into her sort of company and said, right, you're the right type of girl. And I want you to, you know, to help me build this brand in the UK, because it was an American brand. And that's how she started. Most people think Elizabeth Arden was English. She wasn't, but she had racehorses. She went to tea with the king. You know, everything was geared around the British woman. And I think we've lost a bit of that. We lost a bit of the industry focus on women and girls when we lost people like Anita Roddick, who's, you know, a hero. And the same with Estée Lauder. Estée Lauder wasn't British. Estée Lauder was actually a Jew, a Jewish lady, and big Jewish family and network. And interesting enough, gave employment to Jewish women when they couldn't get it in America. So it's we see patterns of these outstanding female founders. And I think I have something to work on in 2026, when I should be hanging up my boots and retiring to Barbados. But I think I have something that provides a service beyond cosmetics to women and girls. And I'm going to be so excited to talk about it. So I'm a bit zipped at the moment, which is hard for me.
You'll have to come back on as a guest when you can.
It'd be lovely, Tom. It'd be great. So that's what I think we have an obligation, other than just selling women lots of pretty cosmetics. I think we have an obligation, if we can, to help people, not just with employment, but also if we can do something through our industry, and we're a clever industry, which I think we can, that we can help women and girls and other vulnerable groups. And that's what I hope to do.
Okay, brilliant. Well, that sounds like a very exciting initiative, and we'll make it very easy for anyone to get in touch with you who wants to get in touch. We'll put a link to your website in the show notes. Elizabeth, thank you very much for coming on as a guest and sharing your insights and your some of your experience. As I said, it'd be very easy for anyone to get in touch with you who wants to. We'll wrap up there. Anything else you just want to share before?
No, thank you. Thank you for having me. And I'd love to come back and talk to you about the next project. That would be great, Tom.
Yeah, you're more than welcome to. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, this podcast was created to celebrate the success stories of seven-figure business owners, giving them a platform to share their insights and lessons learned in order to inspire other business owners. As well as that, it's an opportunity to build new connections. So if you're a seven-figure business owner or someone who works with seven-figure business owners and you're looking for introductions to potential stakeholders, strategic partners, and clients, I'd love to hear from you or have you on as a guest and see if I can help make those connections for you. Just go to synergycfosolutions.co. That's synergycfosolutions.co, and click podcast. On that page, you'll find the link to apply.